Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, believing growth and productivity of Florida depends on a diverse and inclusive workforce. The Able Trust encourages all businesses to include talented Floridians with disabilities as vital staff members. More information is at abletrust.org. WFSU-FM Tallahassee. From the state capitol, Florida Public Radio brings you Capital Report.
An intra-party fight over incentive funding is pitting Florida GOP lawmakers against one another, and even some Democrats are raising concerns about the squabble.
I don't think that is how people should be punished for taking one vote. I don't think that's good for the process. How are we supposed to work together?
Also this week, tensions are on the rise as the House and Senate push dueling bills to address gambling.
You know, the one thing this bill does guarantee, you want certainty? The bill guarantees 2,500 dogs will die over the next 20 years.
We'll also learn how Florida has begun moving away from its long history of get tough on crime approach to nonviolent offenses, and we'll journey to Apalachicola Bay to find out what happens next in Florida's long water battle with Georgia. I'm Tom Flanagan, and this is Capital Report. Florida's governor and state House leaders are at each other's throats over funding for Enterprise Florida and Visit Florida. Nick Evans reports murmurs are growing louder as lawmakers might need a special session to agree on a budget. Both sides are digging in, and the battle lines are becoming clear in a recent letter.
Governor Scott, I was invited today by Brevard County's local zoo to join you tomorrow at a hurriedly arranged event you are planning in our area.
This is Representative Randy Fine, a newly minted GOP lawmaker from Brevard County. Not too long ago, he got on Florida Governor Rick Scott's bad side because of his vote to eliminate two cherished promotional agencies, Enterprise Florida and Visit Florida. Fine wrote the letter after Scott decided to announce the state's tourism numbers at the Brevard Zoo.
Based on media reports I have read, I assume you were visiting to make your case for Enterprise Florida, Visit Florida, and incentive programs.
After nine Republicans on the Careers and Competition Subcommittee voted to shutter the agencies, Scott took the unusual step of touring the state and calling out members of his own party for their votes.
So we all have to be very aggressive now. Let all these politicians in Tallahassee know that if we want to put money into reports, it's going to be tied to more jobs. It's going to be tied to making sure we put money into tourism. We've got to continue to market our state. We've got to continue to compete.
And Fines wasn't the only district that got a visit. The governor made stops in Tampa, Cape Coral, Panama City, and St. Cloud, the home bases of Sean Harrison, Dane Eagle, Jay Trumbull, and Mike LaRosa, respectively. And the bill's sponsor, Flagler Beach Republican Paul Renner, got more than just a visit.
Unfortunately, your state rep, Paul Renner, is playing politics with Florida's jobs. He voted to kill our state's tourism and jobs program, and that will destroy our economy and will lead to higher taxes.
This is a robocall paid for by Scott's campaign organization, Let's Get to Work.
I'm asking you to take action now and tell your rep he can't vote again to kill Florida jobs.
For his part, Renner doesn't fault the governor for traveling the state to make his case. But Tuesday in the House Appropriations Committee, even Democrat Jared Moskowitz took issue with Scott's tactics.
I don't think that is how people should be punished for taking one vote. I don't think that's good for the process. How are we supposed to work together?
The 30-member appropriations panel was the measure's last stop before hitting the House floor. Members voted 18 to 12 in favor of the bill. And the proposal has softened somewhat. The House's anti-incentive position is the brainchild of Speaker Richard Corcoran. He spent the last 3 months staking out a maximalist position. Enterprise Florida is corporate welfare. Visit Florida is rife with waste and lacks transparency. The original bill would have eliminated both, but now the proposal gives Visit Florida $25 million a year and imposes stringent new oversight provisions. Here's Representative Runner.
So we're putting them on a leash, a short leash, and provided that they show measurable progress and success with the new accountability measures we put in place in this bill, then there's certainly an opportunity down the road for them to ask for more.
As the legislative session approaches, it's unclear how much of Corcoran's posturing is a bargaining position. Governor Scott's primary concern is jobs, and he believes Enterprise Florida and Visit Florida are key to getting them. He's unlikely to look kindly on a measure gutting either agency. Corcoran faces a tough sell in the Senate, too. Budget planners there have concerns about oversight and the level of funding, but they believe both agencies serve an important purpose. Still, Renner says there's a better target for economic development,
which is the tax on commercial leases. In my county alone, on a given month, depending on the month, between $220,000 and $260,000 is paid by small, medium, and large businesses that lease their space to the government in this tax that no other state in the country charges.
That is a central plank in Governor Scott's tax cut proposal. And when lawmakers gather for the legislative session, they'll likely be grasping for whatever shred of common ground they can find. In his letter, Representative Fine points to one way forward.
I always found the best outcomes come by sitting down in person and finding common ground. Rather than us talking at each other in the media, I'd prefer to talk to you in person. It is much easier for me to make a 5-minute elevator trip from the 14th floor to the first floor of the Capitol than for you to fly to the Brevard Zoo.
The session begins officially March 7th. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Nick Evans.
The Florida House and Senate have dueling gambling plans, but Regan McCarthy reports leaders insist there's time for the two chambers to come together.
House lawmakers are pushing a plan that essentially freezes gambling as it is now. House Speaker Richard Corcoran says his chamber's proposal creates stability, perhaps his main concern when it comes to gambling rules for the state.
There's three things I would say that surround the gaming bill. I think there's the policy of what gaming looks like in the state of Florida. I think there is the money that's derived from a compact that's entered into or in legislation that may or may not be passed. And the third part is having stability and longevity to that decision. There's a threat or a threat of or a gaming bill almost every single session.
Under the House proposal, the state would extend its current gambling compact with the Seminole Indian Tribe for the next 20 years. Paramutuals that don't currently would not be allowed to offer slot machines, and the idea of paramutual decoupling would be removed from the table for the remainder of the compact. The bill directly counters many of the provisions included in a Senate proposal, which would use a compact agreement negotiated by the governor's office last year as a starting point for talks with the Seminole Tribe. The Senate includes a plan for more paramutuals to offer slot machines. Senate President Joe Negron has said he wants to honor the votes of people who have held referendums supporting slots in their communities. Bradenton Republican Senator Bill Galvano is sponsoring the bill. He's hopeful the legislature will start getting a good idea of where gambling stands early in the session.
The only thing we can do is keep it moving, because that's the only way the negotiations will be real and in earnest.
The distance between the two proposals has raised concerns from some that a gambling solution may not be coming this legislative session. St. Cloud Republican Representative Mike LaRosa, who's pushing the House plan, called the Senate plan a massive expansion and a non-starter. But Corcoran says there's time for the two chambers to come together.
This is a perfect example of where we have this spirited debate on all these different issues, and people are concerned about whether or not how this bodes for session. I think you're looking legitimately at this point in the last decade, maybe. I don't think you've ever seen a House and a Senate, both moving bills, albeit different, this early, that I think prognosticates the potential that we could see resolution there.
But during the first committee hearing on the House bill, members of Corcoran's own chamber raised concerns about the plan.
You know, the one thing this bill does guarantee, you want certainty? The bill guarantees 2,500 dogs will die over the next 20 years.
Coral Springs Democratic Representative Jared Moskowitz wants to see greyhound racing stop. He says the House plan guarantees the races will continue for the next 2 decades, since the measure doesn't include a plan for decoupling or giving paramutuals the option to stop live racing while continuing other gaming activities like poker. Others are concerned about the longevity of the proposal, saying it's unfair to tie the hands of so many future lawmakers. And still other House members express concerns surrounding the proposal's revenue distribution plan, which sends new dollars coming in from the compact to teacher retention and recruitment in both K-12 and higher education, and provides support for charter and voucher schools. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Regan McCarthy.
Still to come on Capitol Report, Florida's leading Republican lawmakers want to be part of the repeal and replace Obamacare process, but some of their constituents worry their health care could be at stake.
I asked for a backup ventilator. It's not medically necessary. That's their favorite line to you. Everything is not medically necessary.
After years of lock them up and throw away the key policies, Florida lawmakers are beginning to change that tune.
If that law were not on the books when Cynthia Powell were sentenced, she almost certainly would have been sentenced to a rational sanction, and we would not have wasted $500,000 on locking her up for 25 years.
Florida lawmakers are looking at making it easier for those wrongly convicted of a crime to receive compensation.
William Dillon, who after 26 years in prison for a murder he did not commit, could not seek compensation because he had a past conviction for drug possession. It's time we address this.
A Supreme Court-appointed lawyer is siding with Georgia in its battle with Florida over access to water. Downriver in Apalachicola Bay, the fishermen who desperately need fresh water are watching their livelihood dry up.
I don't know. I wish that they would just come up with a plan to somehow meet in the middle. I mean, obviously they need water just as much as we need water.
Top Florida Republican lawmakers are heading to Washington, D.C. soon to discuss potential health care changes with their congressional counterparts. They want President Trump's administration to adopt block grant Medicaid funding. But as Sarah Mueller reports, some Floridians worry the sick and the poor will lose their health insurance as a result.
Florida Senate President Joe Negron says he thinks Washington will likely pass a form of block grants for Medicaid. That could mean the federal government gives states a fixed amount of money and leaves it to them to determine who gets what services. Negron says it's a good idea, based on his previous efforts. He spearheaded the state's conversion to Medicaid-managed care.
I think there's things we can do that are even revenue neutral to make the system much more like everyone having a health care card under the Medicaid program.
But those reforms haven't worked out so well for Miami resident Adriana Perales. The 30-year-old has a rare genetic condition that's robbed her of her hearing and left her partially paralyzed. She's currently breathing through a tube. Perales had to sue the state and federal court to get the care she needs under Florida's Medicaid program, says her mom Rita. Adriana was sent home from being hospitalized in early 2015 with no help except for her mother for the first 3 months. The family settled after the state agreed to more health care workers and new standards.
This is a kid in a ventilator, just came out of a critical unit, straight home. How can I even leave her bedside and with an Avon lady that just comes in the evening to help me? So what I have to do is put on some sanitary napkin so that I can at least, you know, buy some time. Not to have to leave her until this lady came to help me out in the evening.
The federal government partners with states to provide Medicaid coverage to ultra-low-income Floridians. It paid about 60 cents of every Medicaid dollar spent in the state last year. Senate President Negron admits some people could lose benefits under a Medicaid block grant program.
I think the goal would be that the state would be the final arbiter of what the benefits should be. My goal wouldn't be to reduce benefits. It would be to do the same kind of measures that are done in private plans to have incentives.
The conversation comes as the Republican-controlled Congress weighs repealing and replacing the Affordable Care Act. Florida is one of a handful of states that did not expand its Medicaid program under the law. Florida Republican Congressman Matt Gaetz recently ripped Obamacare inside his town hall while protesters shouted outside. Gaetz says President Barack Obama shouldn't have let able-bodied people without children get Medicaid.
I do believe that there are people on Medicaid today who may not be on Medicaid following the passage of the Republican plan. That's, you know, we're trying to provide more consumer choice, more options, give people health savings accounts that creates more agency within the individual to make their own decisions about health care.
President Donald Trump said in January that the Republican replacement of Obamacare would provide health coverage for everyone. But Gaetz says he didn't make that promise. And that worries Rita Perales, Adriana's mom. She says she's tired of constantly fighting with Adriana's Medicaid managed care company for more help. The new standards the family fought for may not matter if the state cuts services because the federal government no longer mandates them.
I asked for a backup ventilator. It's not medically necessary. That's their favorite line to you. Everything is not medically necessary.
For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sarah Mueller.
Advocates say even the most rigidly conservative get tough on crime Republicans are seeing the downside of mandatory minimum sentencing. Families Against Mandatory Minimum State Director Greg Newburn talked with Florida Public Radio's Jim Ash about the Senate Judiciary's unanimous vote to create a safety valve for a host of nonviolent crimes, including low-level drug trafficking.
Tell me about the significance of Tuesday's vote and why Senate Bill 290 is so important.
Well, Sam has been working on sentencing reform in Florida since 2011. And you know, if you go back to 2011, the conversations in committees, both in the Senate and the House, were almost exclusively about putting more crimes on the books, making more crimes felonies, increasing sentences. And the idea that you could pass any kind of bill, even out of a committee, that reduced sentences or increased sentencing discretion, that was unthinkable even back then. So SB 290, which makes several changes to sentencing laws, including increasing sentencing discretion for nonviolent offenses, changing some of the ways that nonviolent offenders are punished and where they're housed. That kind of bill, again, was unthinkable just a few years ago, but then it just passed unanimously out of the Criminal Justice Committee in the Senate this week, both with Republicans and Democrats. I'm very conservative Republicans, perhaps the most conservative Republicans in the Senate, voting for that bill.
If you could encapsulate 290, just how do you describe it to people who aren't familiar with the legislation?
What it does is creates what we call a safety valve. So it keeps the mandatory minimums on the books, but then it delineates certain particular exceptions that allow sentencing courts to depart from those minimums if those criteria are met. But yes, the larger question is, yes, it is nonviolent offenders only are covered by that those exceptions.
Greg, Pham follows individual prisoners and their stories. Are you familiar with Cynthia Powell?
She's serving 25 years, and she sold 35 pills back in 2002. I mean, this is an insane sentence. We get nothing in return for this. We're paying almost $500,000 to lock her up for nothing, for just literally no public safety benefit. It's a complete and total waste, and the only reason it exists is because of the mandatory sentencing law. If that law were not on the books when Cynthia Powell were sentenced, she almost certainly would have been sentenced to a rational sanction. Go back to the 2012 OPAGA report about painkiller trafficking, and they make it clear. The folks we're sending are not high-level Pablo Escobar kingpin types. So it appears that there's just no relationship whatsoever between the crime rate generally and mandatory minimum drug law. And that's borne out not only in Florida, but it's borne out in Michigan, where they repealed their harsh mandatory minimum drug laws, and crime fell 30% over the next decade. They released thousands of drug offenders from their prisons. They saved tens of millions of dollars, and crime rate continued to fall. We see the same thing. I mean, it happened in New York. It happened in Delaware. And it's also happened in states that haven't fully repealed their mandatory minimum drug laws, but have just reformed them. South Carolina, Georgia, Mississippi, Oklahoma, just to name a few in the last few years. They've all passed drug reforms that are similar to SB 290, and the results are uniform. We get lower crime rates, smaller prison populations, and we save a lot of money.
Why the change now? What's driving the change of philosophy?
I think the thing that's driving the shift in how many of the legislators are viewing mandatory minimums is simply a recognition that they haven't worked. And also, of course, there's the cost factor as well. When you have, on the one hand, a set of laws that clearly have not achieved their objectives and have created massive negative unintended consequences, and they're tremendously expensive in an environment where everyone's trying to save money, and rightfully so, you have a scenario that's ripe for this kind of reform.
Florida Public Radio's Jim Ash speaking with Families Against Mandatory Minimum State Director Greg Newburn. Florida lawmakers may be looking at getting rid of the state's so-called clean hands provision. As Sasha Cordner reports, that provision stops those with a prior felony record from automatically receiving compensation, even if they were wrongfully imprisoned for a new crime.
My name is Herman Lindsay. I was sentenced to death back in 2006. In 2009, the Florida Supreme Court unanimously found acquitted me of my charges.
About 10 years ago, Herman Lindsay was convicted of robbing and killing a pawn shop owner in 1994. He was later exonerated by the Florida Supreme Court, but because of prior felony convictions, he didn't receive any compensation from the state under a rule in a 2008 law called the Clean Hands Provision.
It's basically saying that we could take anybody that has a criminal record and say, let's falsely incarcerate him. And when he found that it wasn't really him, that it can actually put him out on the streets and we don't even have to worry about it. I didn't receive no apology. I didn't receive no compensation.
While he says he most likely won't be covered, Lindsay is in favor of a bill that would at least modify the eligibility requirements for automatically receiving compensation under the Clean Hands provision. The bill by Republican Senator Rob Bradley would only apply to those with a prior nonviolent felony record.
Out of 26 exonerees in front death row in Florida since 1979, it was a number of four been compensated with the Clean Hands Act. Now perhaps this might open the doors for 10. At least Florida is showing that they're willing to now accept responsibility for the wrongs that they're causing, the victims that they're creating.
Still, Lindsay says he hopes lawmakers will look into repealing the Clean Hands provision.
Because the life that you have to live after you actually been exonerated, especially from death row, you have to keep in mind that I suffer depression, anxiety, but most important, I still serve a life sentence. Anytime I go apply for a job, anytime I go apply for residence, it still has that murder charge on my record. And even though it says not guilty now, who actually gonna give you a chance at a job if you done already had a problem with a murder that you didn't even commit?
And that mindset to remove the Clean Hands provision is now starting to gain bipartisan traction in the Florida legislature. That includes St. Petersburg Republican Senator Jeff Brandis.
If the state and the people of the state get it wrong, it shouldn't matter what individuals have done in their past. We should be willing to stand up and say we made a mistake and we're going to compensate you for that mistake on this issue. So hopefully as this bill moves forward, we will continue that discussion and can find a place to land this with our friends in the House that completely removes that provision.
And Senator Bradley says given Lindsay's story and other feedback he's received over the years, he's convinced and now wants to change his bill to remove Clean Hands altogether.
You guys convinced me. You know, upon reflection, I think the right policy is to completely do away, like the other 32 states, with the Clean Hands provision. And if the House wants to discuss modifying that to bring this home, then we could have that discussion at that period of time. But that's where I stand at this point in time.
Bradley, along with former Senate Democratic leader Arthenia Joyner, have been filing this bill for the past few years. And he says if it dies again in the committee process, he'll continue bringing it back as long as he's in the legislature. Meanwhile, the bill in its current form has unanimously passed its first Senate committee. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sasha Kortner.
You're listening to Capitol Report from Florida Public Radio. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally this week, we take you back earlier this month when a Supreme Court-appointed lawyer ruled against Florida in its decades-long water war with Georgia. As the court prepares to make its final decision, lawmakers are going back to the legislative drawing board. Kate Payne, meanwhile, went to the coast to see what the ruling means for the struggling Apalachicola Bay and its world-famous oysters.
At the end of a river system that feeds booming Atlanta and farms throughout Georgia and Alabama sits Apalachicola Bay. The Army Corps of Engineers decides how much water flows here where the river meets the Gulf. For years, Florida has argued it's not getting its fair share, and the bay and surrounding Franklin County are struggling because of it. T.J. Ward is a third-generation fisherman who works at his family's business in downtown Appalach. Over the past 10 years, he's seen the lack of fresh water take its toll in the form of oyster predators.
One of those, they call them snails, but we call them oyster drills.
the locals do, and they eat the oysters, and they're even cannibalistic. So when they run out of oysters, they'll eat themselves. I mean, they're devastating. That's one thing that's killed the end of the bay that our oyster company's on.
Appalachia is world famous for its oysters, which locals say are the sweetest you'll find anywhere. But oysters aren't just for eating. They form reefs off the coast where they filter the water, protect the shoreline, and are home to countless other fish. Franklin County Commissioner Smokey Parrish says when the oysters go, the entire ecosystem will collapse.
So if we lose the oysters here in Apalachicola Bay, my contention is we lose our estuary, we lose our trout, our redfish, our flounder, our crabs.
Florida took its case against Georgia to the Supreme Court in 2014. Earlier this month, a court-appointed special master found the state didn't adequately prove Georgia is the main culprit in the water shortage. Mark Friedman represents the Apalachicola Riverkeeper, and despite the ruling, he and other advocates are claiming a small victory.
We feel like there's really now something to grasp onto in the special master stating that we have been harmed by the low water flows and stating that the Corps of Engineers can do something about it.
Now North Florida Congressman Neil Dunn is hoping to force the Corps to send more water to the bay.
With my friend and fellow Congressman Al Lawson, I have introduced legislation to nullify the newest water control manual and send it back to the Corps for rewriting in a way that recognizes the findings of the special master regarding the very real damage done to our economies and our ecosystem.
After being immersed in the water wars his entire life, TJ Ward is exasperated, but hopeful for some kind of compromise.
I don't know. I wish that they would just come up with a plan to somehow meet in the middle. I mean, obviously they need water just as much as we need water, and that's the main thing I just don't understand. There's too much politics involved in all this.
But U.S. Senator Bill Nelson says lawmakers have been trying to compromise for years.
The problem is we had it in legislation 2 years ago, and right at the end when everything's either yay or nay, just before the Congress adjourns, then, a Georgia senator or a Georgia representative will get into it and say, we're not going to let this pass. But that's a fight worth having.
Smokey Parrish says they're running out of choices.
If you look around, there's no 10-story condominiums here. There's no theme parks. There's no Walmart. There's none of that. And it's all about protection of our environment. And we put all of our eggs in this one basket, and we're going to continue to fight.
The Supreme Court will consider the special master's recommendation before making a final ruling. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Kate Payne.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Jim Ash, Sasha Cordner, Nick Evans, Lynn Hatter, Regan McCarthy, Sarah Mueller, and Kate Payne. We also thank our contributing Florida Public Radio stations. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Ken Smith, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Follow us on Twitter at FBR Cap Report. And please join us again next week for more reports from the state capitol.
Audio copies of Capitol Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809. You can also hear Capitol Report online, including archives of past shows at fprn.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following: The Able Trust, 25 years of connecting businesses with workers with disabilities. Businesses are encouraged to interview and hire talented and loyal Floridians with disabilities as they seek to broaden their customer base and reach all of Florida's diverse population. AbleTrust.org. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. This is Florida Public Radio.